And my passion is to rid this great nation of America of soccer.
Taking aim at America's recent soccer craze.
I'm never going to rest, never going to tire of trying to show the rest of my fellow citizens that this is a waste of our time, energy, and resources.
Up and down the field, and every once in a while, a ball accidentally goes in. She also suggests the popularity of soccer here in the U.S. is due in part to the influx of immigrants, saying, quote, I promise you, no American whose great-grandfather was born here is watching soccer. Joining us now,
until there is no soccer being played in this country. Until I can drive past a local park on a weekend morning and not see a single person playing soccer. I have a dream. I will not rest until I see nothing but baseball, football.
I just win again, then win again like Wimbledon I serve. Yeah, that's him again, the sound, the engine in is like a bird. You see fireworks, a Corvette tire skirt, the boulevard. I know how you work, I know just who you are.
Hey, buddy, welcome back. This is Let's Fix Football. We're back. It's your host, Gabe Lesser. I'm joined by Evan Mateer. Evan, we're back. We're doing this show again. We're rebooting, I guess, MCU style. I would say this is our Captain Marvel, if you will, of a reboot. I don't know.
Sorry, it's our huge retcon. We have actually always been a once a month show.
That's true.
That is what it was from the start. And if you don't believe that, then yeah, you're the crazy one.
Yeah, it's not us that's crazy. It's you're the crazy one for even remembering that this show existed in anything other than its current form, and that it had anything other than dumb shit to say all the time. So
I'm very excited for the current form, though. Just so everyone knows, we're very excited to be back. It was kind of a challenge ever since I moved to the West Coast to keep up with the weekly scheduling, just because time zones and life. But I think that this format's gonna suit our strengths.
You changed jobs too, so you had less time, which is always exciting. It's always good to get a job that takes up all of your energy, and then when you aren't doing it, it makes you so tired that you feel like the only thing you really want to do is lie around and watch TV.
That's the dream. That's the American dream. They tell us that the American dream is dead, and I say that they're lying.
I say you lie, sir.
Call you out for your lies. The American dream is working 80 hours a week doing things that are I'll just leave it there.
And screaming at your dog for eating your Bose headphones.
Oh my god, yeah.
Or for barking during your podcast. Or it's also doing all those things while watching your sports team lose and just being totally normal about it and not having a total meltdown while you're watching that. And it's
so
being
I'll tell
a regular
you, tell
guy.
You. I'll tell you a quick story. So, and I'm sure I'm not alone in this, but when I was a young lad, watching primarily the Baltimore Ravens. I was really mostly an American football fan when I was a kid. I watched a little bit of baseball, a little bit of college basketball, but really it was about the Ravens. And I would just get just so furious. I had such an unhealthy relationship to the Ravens. And the part of the problem is the first season I really watched was the Super Bowl season. So I was very conditioned for winning.
Yeah.
And then it didn't go that way. And I was 12, 13, 14 years old. I'd throw these temper tantrums. I'd throw shit. I'd hit things. And it was so bad that my mom would have to threaten to not let me watch the games because it upset me so much. happily, I could still, like everyone else, get frustrated about sports now as an adult. But it turns out that not everybody has grown out of the temper tantrum throw shit phase.
Oh, yeah, that's true. I mean, I still haven't really grown out of it. That's why when my sports teams are in very important matches, I try not to invite people over. But, what I don't do is throw my temper tantrums in places where I know people are going to be videotaping me or any more destroy expensive equipment that I use to, do my job or watch the sports. So that's why we specifically today wanted to shout out to one particular king. PSG fan who destroyed his large flat screen TV watching his team lose to Manchester United.
and I understand the impulse. I get it. Maybe it felt good in the moment, but it can't have felt good afterwards.
As someone who has personally destroyed stuff, like, not like a TV, thank God. I've chucked shit at my TV. It's funny that we found each other. We're spiritual, like, brothers, Evan, because when I was in high school and I was doing the same stuff, and you could ask any of my high school friends, there's this particularly famous moment of me whipping, like, one of those plastic, not really full bottles of, I think it was, like, ketchup or something, because we were all, like, having burgers at the TV when I was at my house, like, and everyone just kind of being silent because, you know, something happened in the game we were watching. I'm not sure exactly. It was I just, like, losing it, and spent my whole adult life either telling myself, you have to learn how to calm down or you can't watch sports anymore. Well, I mean,
it really does, like, make people around you uncomfortable. Like, it's not pleasant to be around somebody who's, like, throwing a temper tantrum over sports.
It's not pleasant to be around someone who's throwing a temper tantrum at all, generally. Exactly. Like, it's not fun to be around someone who's having a psychotic meltdown.
I mean, I remember Gabe, I might have told this story on the show before, but I came over to watch the Champions League final with you in, it would have been 2014, I think, the summer of 2014.
Oh, my God.
And I left at halftime.
Yeah, that was smart of you.
Because I didn't care enough to deal with the amount of stress that was going on in this room full of other Madrid fans.
Yeah, and Josh was there,
Josh
too.
Josh was there, yeah.
And I was broken. That game broke me in such an incredible way. It is an experience that I will never forget because of how deeply psychotic it made me feel. Like, afterwards, looking back on the experience, I'm like, I'm not a serial murderer, but, like, I think there is some little thing in there that's like, this dude could snap. Like, that was fucked up. Like, I like, sat and, like, cradled my health on the ground. I was, like, so stressed out by this match, and, like, I don't know. Josh was there, and he actually also was having a pretty normal experience.
I remember for a little while you guys were really directing your angst at the English language announcers. The commentators, you switched to the Spanish language broadcast.
It's so embarrassing.
Only momentarily sated you.
Well, but you know, we didn't do is we didn't run onto the pitch in the middle of a game and punch a player in the face.
Jesus
which,
Christ, you did okay, not.
We did not do that. I'm not saying I wouldn't have done that, but again, this is just a really right back to form for us. Just shout out to this guy who did that. Jack Grealish got punched in the face by some random angry man in what can only be described as like an 1890s English gangster Cockney hat.
He's right out of Peaky Blinders, like 100%, literally. Which also takes place in Birmingham. So I guess that just makes sense.
It does make sense. But he was dead in the middle of a game. The pitch invader just rushed up from behind him and then punched him in the face like it's like the 1970s NBA. And they're just having a brawl on the pitch. It's incredible. I've honestly, in all my 30 years of watching sports, I've never seen anything like that before.
I mean, there's the tennis player who got stabbed at courtside. That was pretty fucking crazy.
I guess
crazy.
You're right. We don't watch Brazilian and other South American competition stuff because I bet that happens more.
Here's my problem with the Grealish thing. Not a problem with the substance, a problem with my personal reaction to it. On the one hand, I know intellectually, I understand that it's unacceptable. Players can get hurt. This Jack Grealish is an innocent guy. He got punched in the face, and that's not cool. The problem is that the other side of me watches the video and can't stop because it's freaking hilarious.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's too
very
funny.
It's very funny to watch this guy get clocked, and I feel bad because it was a bad thing, and it shouldn't happen. And I guess I'm helping perpetuate it by enjoying it, but goddamn it, can't stop.
And you know what? I refuse to apologize for thinking this is funny. I'm not gonna, you know, enjoyment shame myself from watching this video. Don't run onto the pitch and punch people. That's dumb and bad, and you shouldn't do it. But the fact that someone did it that fact does not make this video of this exact incident where Jack Grealish gets hit, like, punched in the face by the guy from Peaky Blinders to be any less funny when I watch it. Like, it's just too good. And as you noted earlier when we talked about this, the dude gets up from the ground after he gets, let's be clear, sucker punched by someone who rushed from behind to punch him in the face, and gets up, plays the rest of the game, and then scores the winner, which is incredibly badass.
That is fucking awesome. And it was a cool winner, too. It was like from outside the box, like cutting across the entire box into the bottom quarter. It was a very, was a cool very shot. Cool shot.
That's really cool. And, you know, it's also a shout out because that is extremely English. I think the only time, like, I would not expect, and I don't know what this says about me, but I would not expect someone playing in Spain to be able to get punched in the face and get back up and score.
Like, I compose themselves.
Like, compose right? themselves enough to do that. But, like, I just feel like that's a really, like, you know, and maybe I'm just perpetuating the same, like, we're going to talk about this in a little bit, like, the same, like, well, this is what the you know, the good English lads, right? Like, the good English boys.
They're all grit, blood grit and grit.
And blood. Like, but you know what? Sometimes they are, and that's exactly what the hell that was. That was amazing. I mean, Ron Artest got into the stands and fought some fans, and then he got ejected. So God, I guess it's not really the same thing. But
I always forget about the battle at the palace.
Malice at the palace, man.
One of what the classics. An amazing event. I have such a vivid memory of that happening, actually, like when it happened. It was insane.
I was extremely team Ron Artest, though. That guy's got a beer thrown at him. Like, he lost his mind, obviously, and like he shouldn't have done it, but like, don't throw a beer at the player. That's such the worst possible thing you could do. And like, in the NBA, you're right by them. So like, what do you expect when you hurl your beer at someone? That's a move that if you're in a bar, you get into a fight.
I mean, it's almost announcing that you want to fight, right? Like when you spill a beer on somebody, you're attempting to provoke them into a fight. That's the only reason that you do it.
Yeah. I mean, we have a friend who used to get really drunk and smash his head into people. And like, that's the same thing. You do that. You're trying to get into a fight with someone.
All of this kind of raises the broad, like, clearly there are a lot of people who are struggling with watching sports.
Maybe they shouldn't watch sports.
Having an extremely negative impact. If you are running onto the pitch because you hate Jack Grealish that much, like, what are you doing at the game?
Yeah, what's going on, man?
That bad, why are you there? What are you getting out of this equation? You have paid the money to show up at the game and become so incensed that you will commit a crime.
It is. It actually is really insane. It's funny because to some extent I was going to answer the question of why do we care and why do we watch sports, because we're just driving us all insane with, well, actually watching this, you know, fucking Sherlock Holmes punch Jack Grealish is why we watch sports. But it's, you know, it's why we watch sports, but for the guy who actually rushed onto the field to attack a player, like, that dude shouldn't be watching sports. Sports cannot fill the void in your soul, and if you try to make it fill that, like, dark, deep spot in your soul, you're just gonna end up ruthlessly angry and rushing onto the field to fight someone who you've never met and has never done anything wrong to you.
If it's that, if you make it that it's central to, like, your character,
right,
and to your happiness, like, here's the thing, your sports team's gonna lose, and they're gonna lose fairly frequently,
right?
You know, depending on what the standards of the team you're watching are, they might lose a lot, or they might only not win all the time, but you're still going to be unhappy a lot of the time.
In fact,
just look at how unhappy so many Madrid fans are about this one bad season in the, like, last decade.
Right, exactly.
And they're ready to throw themselves in front of a bus.
Exactly.
Because this one season's gone badly. And you know, it's kind of this, it ties in almost with the conversations we had with Ohm a few months ago about how an unhealthy relationship with sports leads people to, you know, make all kinds of excuses for Cristiano Ronaldo or other star players, because, like, it's all they have. Like, they can't let go to it. Nothing bad can happen because their happiness is too bound up in their sports team being good and their sports heroes being good. And it's just all bad. And it's a thing that I think that, like, every time I let, like, a Spurs loss ruin my Saturday, think about, like, what am I doing here?
Right. This is supposed to be fun, right? Like, this at base, right? Sports I mean, we've talked about this before, but base sports is about entertainment, and when it's not fun and it's not entertaining, then you I think we should ask the question, what the hell are we doing? Why are we doing this then if it's not fun, if it's not entertaining? And that's one of the things that, like, I post occasionally to remind people, like, yo, like, if you are not happy and this is not making you happy, you cannot do this. Like, that is actually an option for you. This, you know, I know people like to say this is my, like, religion, this is whatever, but, like, you know, it's also not any of those things, and it doesn't need to be. And, like, you can make an identity for yourself outside of your sports team that you do.
And you should. And you should have an identity for yourself. You should have an identity for yourself outside your sports team. Like, if every social media account you have is Madrid Lover 1667, you know,
right.
And you have no other hobbies and no other interests, and the only thing that brings you joy in life is Madrid doing well, right? You're probably doing it wrong.
There's going to be a moment when Madrid doesn't do well, and the next thing that you're going to turn to is going to be, you know, it's going to be a very dark time in your life. Like, I can only say that from experience with the people who have, you know, sent a bunch of hate mail and shit to Managing Madrid and all of our staff, because
that's insane.
Because the team isn't doing well. It's like, you need to find something else to do with your life and accept that. That's fine. And you can enjoy the dumb things in sport like we do, like the fact that Kepa refused to be substituted and didn't come out somehow, and why, what exactly the rules are for what happens when a manager tells a player to be subbed off and then the player literally refuses. And the fact that I don't know if I've ever seen something like that happen before.
This was extremely funny. So we had Kepa, the goalkeeper for Chelsea in the League Cup finals, which, you know, was very important to about six people. And so what? It was towards the end of the game, and there had been some question earlier about whether Kepa was hurt a little bit or not. But I think the big thing is that his backup had previously played for City, and they wanted, I think that really the manager wanted him in for the PKs that were going to come.
Yes, that's right.
Because he practiced PKs against them every day in practice for whatever number of years. And so they call Kepa's number, they throw it up. I don't know if they ever actually throw it on the board. He's told he's going to be subbed off. And he just starts waving his finger in the air. No, I won't be subbed off.
Which is amazing. I don't know.
Freaking sorry, he blew a fucking gasket on the touchline, and was talking with the official for a while. But like, then he just goes back and sits down, and the sub never happens. And I think our question, besides the fact that this is very funny, is like, can a player do that?
What is? And I have not researched this, and refuse to research this. But why can't? Is it possible for a player to refuse to be substituted? I mean, I think there's got to be some moment in the rules that say, like, once the coach has announced, like, officially told the referee of the substitution, then the player has to come off. But if, like, there's, like, some unofficial communication beforehand, the player's like, no, I don't want to, and the coach then doesn't substitute him off.
So I just did a quick Google search, and here's the first hit. It's from Substitute Association Football Wikipedia account. And it says that under the laws of the game, and I love that they call them the laws.
It's
amazing. The referee has no specific power to force a player to be substituted, even if the team manager or captain has ordered the player to be substituted. The rules say, quote, if a player who is to be replaced refuses to leave, play continues.
That's amazing. That's really cool. Yeah,
apparently a player could just refuse to leave. This is actually amazing. How many players now are going to, like, if it's like, say it's a Champions League final and they want to sub you out, you're just like, nah.
Well, right. And, like, obviously Kepa has had some major repercussions, and he has not started, I think, since then. I don't know. But, you know, he's immediately fell out with his coach. So that's a very good way to fall out with your coach. But, like,
yeah, I mean, I would never play him again if I was the coach, right?
Yeah, like, you got to get someone who listens.
I don't care how much you cost. I don't care how, you know, how good you are. You just wouldn't play anymore. Because if you're the coach, if you let that go, you've lost the team. Like, well, you have no authority anymore.
To the extent that Sarri even has this team at all right now, I don't really understand. That's one of the interesting – threads of this season. When I came into it, I was so sure that this particular iteration of Chelsea were going to be so good because I felt like Sarri is such a high-level coach, but they've just bafflingly bad.
They just drew Wolves this morning, and they only drew them on a 94th-minute equalizer by Hazard, who just does ridiculous Hazard things occasionally.
Yeah.
And he might well be gone in the summer. So
yeah, it's really
– especially if Madrid decides to just tear it all down.
Yeah.
It's crazy. It's crazy. It's actually insane that a player can just refuse to go. And I agree with you that usually it's going to cause you cause them to just bench you. But I was thinking of a situation where, like, it's a cup final, and you just care about that one game. You know, you can just force your way. Like, okay, so what happens if I don't come out? They'll be forced to sell me. Whatever, fine. I'll go play somewhere else.
Right. That's true. Yeah, I think that the total number of scenarios where this would happen and where it might actually happen in real life. I mean, I can't believe we watched this happen in real life. But the total numbers of situations where this might happen is very limited. But then again, we saw it in exactly that scenario you were talking about, right? It's a cup final. Kepa is like, I know I don't want to be substituted out for the penalties. I think I want to take them. And he was not substituted out, and then he lost
the cup
penalties. Yeah, they lost,
and that's the crucial. Like, me, if you win, right? If you win, but you make a heroic save to win the cup,
right?
Perhaps you come out at the press conference and you're like, I was right, you know, I knew I could do it. But when you lose,
yeah,
you don't even have that half leg to stand on anymore.
That's right. Let's jump into this next topic. So this is obviously a very particular topic of note to me because I've been dealing with it for a long time. But in this particular case, it's also a Real Madrid topic. It's the treatment of, or the sort of different league treatment of foreigners in different places. And in particular, with respect to Gareth Bale, who is completed a disappointing season with Real Madrid so far. But I think that the thing that we actually want to discuss is not like how Bale's done this season or whatever, but really the way that the media, right? This is my understanding, the way the media has kind of turned him into kind of a boogeyman. Every country, I would imagine, has different, I know every country has different relationships with this, but with their foreign players, you know, there are media outlets and local outlets are very, sometimes very clearly, sometimes less clearly, but almost always there's going to be a bias towards representing the young local players well and making the foreign big name or even not so big name players seem worse. With Bale in Spain, it's been a constant hate relationship where the Spanish media has spent his entire career in Spain essentially attacking him. And it's fascinating to me still that he has decided to remain in Spain despite this. And
blows me away.
I have to say, is an unbelievably successful career. You know, he's got all the, I mean, like, what do they want? He's got all those rings. It's kind of hard to argue with.
Ball don't lie, as they say.
But it reminds me a lot of a situation in England when, and I wrote an article, like, when I was in college about this, about how that everyone in England attacked Cristiano Ronaldo. And this is when he was playing for United, so I didn't even have any personal relationship to it. But everyone in England attacked Cristiano Ronaldo as some sort of horrible diver, and, you know, he's this little shit and blah, blah, blah. But the people, and then there were all these pieces around that time, like an epidemic of diving is coming into the Premier League. And I remember very vividly that the only people that they cited as emblematic of this epidemic of diving were foreigners. It was like Ronaldo, and not just foreigners, just foreigners with like dark skin, like,
yeah,
Ronaldo.
Yeah,
and
well, and
Drogba,
the stereotype
and
for diving, right? The stereotype for diving is Iberian players and South American players, right? Like,
right.
That's the stereotypes, for that. But I think that, I mean, I think that it's kind of a multifaceted question, and that's why I wanted to talk about it, because, you know, for me, there's like two sides to this coin, right? One is what you were just talking about, which is with respect to both the media and also fans. I kind of put them in a similar category.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, what should fans expect from, you know, foreign players who come to play in the league, and how should they treat them? And I think that there's some very obvious baselines of they shouldn't be racist. like that's a pretty good place to start.
Unfortunately, it's a place that we have not even gotten to yet. But yes, it's a good place to start.
But then there's the other question of, like, you know, from a player's perspective, what obligations to the fans and the country and the league does the player have to try to become, if he's never going to, you know, Gareth Bale is never going to become a Spaniard. But what is his obligation to try to fit in more? And I think this comes up all the time in discussions with Gareth Bale. He hasn't tried to learn Spanish, and he'll like claim that, oh, his, you know, his agent says his Spanish is quite good, but nobody really believes he speaks Spanish at all. And you know, that was the base of the Marcelo comment about him not speaking Spanish. And, you know, to what extent does a player have an obligation to, you know, to try to become a cultural fit for the league and the country that he's gone to play into? And I don't think that it's an easy question from either side, because obviously, if the player doesn't, you know, doesn't learn the language, doesn't seem like a cultural fit, I think it's fairly obvious that fans are going to have a less favorable view of that player. What is the limit of the fairness of that opinion, though? Like, how far does that go
before
it's become unfair player?
Honestly, I have a very probably skewed vision of this, being a Madrid fan and feeling like the Spanish kind of the dailies that are the mouthpiece of I think a very specific vision of Real Madrid fandom have a very negative and really poisonous view of this. But I think the players have one main obligation, and that's to be professionals and treat this like the thing that they do, like their job, like it is. They're very highly paid professionals, and what they should be doing is doing that and making, understanding that they're being paid and that they have people who count on them, and they have an obligation to the fans because that is part of their job. But it's also like, you know, no one is like, one of the things that Bale gets accused of, quote unquote, and this is what I just hate this so much. Like, he got accused, and this is not even a thing that his teammates, like Courtois gave an interview to one of these same dailies, right, where jokingly he said that Bale and Kroos, well, they're not Spanish. Like, he was talking about how he has like a Spanish wife and his kid is and lived in Madrid. And he's like, well, they're not I've become Spanish. And he was literally, it was just talking about himself, and it was just kind of a silly interview that he was doing where he was like, well, like, see, I'm Spanish, and like, I, the other night I went out with all my Spanish teammates, and you know, Bale and Kroos were great, but they had to get home for dinner, and you know, because we had training at 9:30 in the morning, they wanted to go to sleep. And then the Spanish papers took that quote, and it was like, Bale doesn't like his teammates and like refuses to become, you know, active in club matters, and like, he's an outcast and all this shit. And it's like, dude, it was like, he was literally giving a story about how he went out to drinks and partying with his teammates at like midnight on a Tuesday, and Bale is the bad guy who wants to go home and have a full night's sleep because he's a goddamn professional who has to be at work the next morning. What the hell are we talking about? Like, it's amazing how this shit gets twisted. And if that story were about anyone, where if it were Bale who was like, yeah, I went out with my friends in the club and it was really cool and we were out really late, but you know, Asensio wanted to go home and get a full night's sleep, the Spanish media would be talking about how Bale was irresponsible and how Asensio was like a real professional or whatever. And it's like, this, it's so clear that these people have an agenda out. And what you need to do as a fan, I think, is just, you expect the basics. You don't expect them to be a saint, you know, but you expect them to comport themselves with a certain level of professionality in their dealings with the club, and that's it. That's the end of the line. Like, if they, I mean,
yeah,
I think I don't think that, that, but I think that's a lot of from from someone who has a very cynical and long-term feud with people who have poisoned me from ever believing that you can ask or expect people to like you when you sign for a club, you take on a new idea. Like, these Madrid dailies have poisoned the idea of these players like feeling the shirt because of how much they use that as an attack on foreign players.
Yeah. I think that your position on like what the obligation of players are, I think it makes sense. I think the problem is that, and this kind of goes back to our first discussion about like the place of sports in people's lives. Like, I think that the problem is it doesn't match people's lived experience of what sports is to them.
No, right? That's totally
it's,
right.
It's not just a thing that they go watch for a couple hours and it'd be great if Gareth Bale scores. It's like this cultural icon of what it means to be, you know, in Madrid, to be, you know, be a resident or, you know, a person, you know, in that city. It's, you know, part of it is the football club and the players of the club. And I think that that's where it ends up taking on this like this heightened cultural sense. And then once it does that, that's when you get to this dark place where whether it's English people enforcing cultural stereotypes against brown skin players from South America who come to play, or it's Spanish media enforcing this cultural divide between, you know, kind of Southern Europe and Western Europe about like, well, we're much more chill and we'll go hang out and have dinner, but he's stodgy and goes to bed, you know, early or whatever, right? You get to this dark cultural measuring sticky where it becomes, you know, it's like this proxy for cultural nationalism.
Totally.
Ugly and unfortunate. I don't really have much more to say about that other than people have been very mean to Gareth Bale, and I just it is beyond insane to me that he hasn't left Madrid.
What really strikes me on just finishing that thought is that maybe he hasn't left Madrid because he actually loves Spain, like he said many, many times, and he was always wanted to play for Real Madrid, and the only reason he hasn't left is because of his own feeling of connection to the club and the country, despite what these absolute charlatan fucking proto-fascists are saying in the media about him not, like, being a proper Spaniard because he doesn't want to go out drinking until 4 a.m. every night. Like, these... You know, I actually, my understanding of it and everything that anyone has ever, that I know has told me about him, I have not personally gotten the chance to meet him or talk to him, but the people that I know at the club and the people that I know who have, everyone to a T says that he's just a quiet, professional kid who is very happy with his wife and life in Spain, and like, the idea that would be something that you can hold against him is such a such an upsetting thing to me. Like, and it strikes me that they wouldn't be doing this if his name wasn't Gareth, if it was like, you know, Paco or whatever, they would have no problem with it probably. So, and then this is, and we've dealt with this a little bit on the other show that I do, Managing Madrid podcast, but like, this is also typical of any time there are just going to be people who have an agenda, and this particular anti kind of foreign agenda that these Spanish media people have manifests itself whenever there's a young Spanish player who is behind in the pecking order to one of these foreign players. And I've seen it before. And one of the most classic examples of this is in 2002, 2003, I was living in Spain, and that was the first season that Real Madrid had Ronaldo, like OG, like, you know, doing all those step over, like, not like, you know, a fucking like Brazilian R9 Ronaldo. And he was first season at the club. The media ran constant articles about how he was fat. Really weird. That's a real weird one. I wasn't even like trying to bring that up, but that was a part of it. But also they constantly criticized him and made calls constantly to have him benched in favor of a young Spanish player called Javier Garcia Portillo, who had this amazing record where he would come in the last 10 minutes of the game and score. And then it turned out that that was just a fluke, because of course it was a fluke, and Ronaldo is brilliant and had an amazing season, but it was constant. It was constant, and it was all of these articles about, well, why is Madrid starting Ronaldo when they could be starting this other guy who, let's face it, is Spanish.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you see that you see the English version of that in the EPL in other ways too, like in the terms of they'll talk about the English premium. Which is the premium on the transfer fee that you'll pay for a decent young English player over a decent young any other player, and it sometimes that'll be justified in terms of, you know, you might be getting a homegrown player, so there's some rules, you know, with respect to that. But I think really it's that there's a perception that there's a marketing advantage to having a good English player. And I think that it's real. I think a big part of Tottenham's ascendancy the last few years has been that the core of a big part of the core of the Tottenham team is an English core, right? Dele and Ellie and Harry Kane are English players and at skill positions where England doesn't often produce good players. Yeah. And there's other young English players in the team. And I think that it's a similar phenomenon to what you're talking about, this kind of preference for local players. And I think there's some rationality behind it. Of course, a player who's from the country is going to play better in the media. But then it can go this step too far where it becomes this kind of hostility towards the foreign players.
Yeah. Let's jump on. So another thing we wanted to talk about, the U.S. women's national team has stepped up in their ongoing fight to improve their contracts and have filed a gender discrimination lawsuit against USSF. Evan, do you want to just quickly talk us through what that means?
Yeah. So there's been a few different lawsuits and legal actions filed in the kind of long saga of the women's national team fighting for better treatment, especially in relation to the men's national team, which I think most people are probably fairly familiar with a lot of the issues that we're talking about. It's, you know, it's pay, but it's also more than just pay. It's accommodations, it's travel, it's medical facilities, it's working conditions in the sense of the types of pitches that they're expected to play on. You know, it's a million different things that the women's national team has been fighting for, particularly over the last, I don't know, maybe 4 or 5 years or so. They had filed previously a complaint with the federal government, an administrative complaint about gender discrimination, which is kind of a first step that you have to take in the U.S. legal system for this type of lawsuit. And they just recently got permission to file an actual lawsuit. So they have now sued in federal court USSF, alleging that USSF is breaking the law with respect to payment of the women's national team compared to the men's national team and other working conditions. And basically the law says you can't, you know, the law's explicit. You're not allowed to discriminate in employment decisions, including pay and accommodations, on the basis of sex or gender. Like, that's the rule. And so they're alleging that USSF has essentially admitted that they are paying the women's national team less, which is true. The USSF has never denied it. And they cite all the other differences in accommodations as examples of unfair treatment, and they allege that this violates the law. And so that's kind of where it stands with the complaint. You know, we were talking before the show, like, what does this really mean, and how likely are they to win? Like, I mean, I'm not an expert on employment law. I think the big problem they're going to run into is that the law, while it says you can't discriminate on the basis of sex and employment decisions, that doesn't mean that every time you treat male and women differently, you violate the law. If there's a non-discriminatory purpose, if there's some other reason other than the fact that they're women that you're paying them less, you can probably get away with it. And USSF has always held the line that the difference in treatment between the men's team and the women's team is based on the economics of the sport, and that, frankly, you know, that just bluntly, that the men's team brings in more revenue, and so the men's team gets paid more, and that for the same reason they spend more on accommodations and everything else. Women's team comes back and says, well, we've been more profitable in the past, which is true. USSF will come back and say, well, if we paid you more, you wouldn't be more profitable anymore. And so that's kind of the fundamental, like, argument. Of the legal argument. But I think that this is more than just a legal play. I don't know if they expect to win this lawsuit. I think that, you know, a lot of times these lawsuits are filed in the course of labor negotiations, kind of to stake out a position.
I was going to say this
pressure on the other.
This
party.
Strikes me as a classic, and we can discuss the kind of what, you know, moral or whatever justifications for this, which I think are very much different from what the legal justifications are. But I think the play, it's as just kind of neutral, and as you know, from a standpoint of, if I were advising the women, this is the kind of move I would have taken as well, because as we've seen in the past, just recently, the threat of a lawsuit that, especially a lawsuit that has a lot of moral force behind it, even if the law in this area is not particularly developed in favor of you, like in this case, gender discrimination law is very much not particularly well developed in this area. The very threat of it is enough to make the other side move a little bit. And the threat of discovery, the threat of protracted ongoing litigation, companies and organizations don't want to have this looming threat, and they want to deal with this stuff more quickly. So I think I think you're right that it's a negotiating ploy. We saw it obviously in the crew stuff. I think what it shocked a lot of people, including myself, that it was so successful. And I think the lawsuits had were a huge part of that. And obviously we didn't test any of the legal theories. We don't know if those would have held up, precisely because the lawsuits in large part convinced MLS to settle and negotiate with people in the Columbus area and save the crew or keep the crew in Columbus, which is great. And this, I think, is very much probably with the direction they're going with this lawsuit as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. I was reading somewhere that because of the current CBA that they're under, they don't have the opportunity to strike, to actually have a strike until like 2021. And so, you know, with that off the table, they're left looking for other avenues of leverage in order to get concessions. And they're also left with, you know, seeking other opportunities to keep the plight of the women's team in the media, right, in the headlines. And I think that this lawsuit brings it back to the fore for a bit, and it'll continue to give lots of opportunities for them to highlight, you know, through the course of litigation, for them to highlight what their case is in a substantive sense, not just in a legal sense, but
right,
substantively,
exactly.
Here's what our complaints are, and just keep those in front of the public eye.
And especially heading into the summer where the World Cup is happening and they're, you know, going to be very much on everyone's minds, I think it's exactly the right time to do this. So,
yeah, I mean, I think it's very smart because, you know, it creates two big problems for USSF, right? One is what we were just talking about, which is like a PR problem of, you know, they want the women's national team to go for the story to be the success of the team.
Right.
That not the story to be, look at this great team that is being treated unfairly by, you know, rich money bags, U.S. soccer. And by doing this right before the World Cup, and when we're about to spin up for World Cup coverage, it's going to make sure that every interview is going to include a question about the treatment of the women's national team. And then the second is what you were just talking about. The second benefit of this is the more legal aspect, right? Which is the threat of discovery. And I think that, you know, whenever you have these corrupt as shit organizations who are constantly in trouble anyway, you know, the last thing in the world that they want is somebody with the vast power of discovery in the U.S. legal system, you know, at their disposal to just go sifting through the books and sifting through their email, finding whatever it is that they can find in there about misconduct. And, you know, they don't want to be exposed that way. And I think this terrified MLS and U.S. soccer with the crew. And I think it's going to terrify U.S. soccer here that if they get to discovery, you know, for people who don't know, discovery is the ability of parties in a litigation to learn and demand information and documents from the other side. And you can learn, you know, anything that might even be arguably relevant to your claim, you can pretty much ask for it. And in a, you know, in a gender discrimination type lawsuit, that's going to include all of the financials,
right,
of U.S. soccer.
It's just, it is a huge threat. And it's a very much the kind of, and it's one of the only tools at their disposal. And so they have to leverage both the threat of this massive opening up and annoyance, of this corporate annoyance, with also the very real possibility that, and with their ability to leverage their own media, right, access and ability to shape the public consciousness around this issue. Those are the only two tools they have legally in the, or mm-hmm. practically in the book right now to improve their conditions. And so, you know, I think it's totally fair. I mean, and also substantively, there may, you know, just putting aside whether, you know, what the law is, I mean, it does seem to me like there's a huge cause for concern about this. Obviously, there's more in the men's game, more money in the men's game, but I don't think that is particularly meaningful to me when it comes to how you distribute the resources, especially when, as we said, the U.S. women's team is both more profitable and much better than the men's team.
Yeah, you know, I probably take a slightly different view on this in that, for me, the fact that the men's team makes more money doesn't shock my conscience in the same way because I do see the economic justification that, you know, as a general rule, you're going to be paid commensurate to, you know, what the market is for what you're bringing to the table, and the market for what the men's team is bringing to the table is substantially larger. And so that, like, that doesn't shock my and there's also this other little detail that changes things a little bit in that men only get game bonuses and roster bonuses, like when they actually get selected for the team, where all of these women's national team players are kind of on a constant payroll with contracts. It's a little bit different. But what I think where the women's strongest case is, and I think that they, by the way, do have a case for making more money than they make. Mm. But if to the extent that the case is making
exactly the same
as the men's game, I think it's going to be a hard sell that, you know, there should just be an equal distribution of resources. But and so they have an argument they should make more money based on the success. I think that's a strong argument. I think, but what their strongest argument is, and where I think they have made some gains, and I think they're going to keep making gains, is in the kind of non-pay treatment that the women's team gets compared to the men's team. You know, the accommodations they see.
Oh yeah, that is that's such
travel. The stadiums they're expected to play in.
Yeah, that's such a no-brainer. Shit. Yeah, and it's that, you know, even if we're not going to get everyone maybe, you know, to agree on for example, I obviously think that I have no problem, especially at the national team level. I don't think, because people see it as such an honor to play for their country, and I think there's a level of this where we're both pretending it is a business while kind of saying it's not. One of the ways that we can make it seem less like a overt, you know, and truly corrupt business is by essentially paying everyone exactly the same to play, whether they're Alex Morgan or, you know, Josh Sargent or Christian Pulisic or any of these people, or down to the lowest member, everyone who gets the same kind of bonuses, the same pay structure. And because really the point is more about showing, kind of doing a political message with it, like we're all equal anyways, but I don't have a problem with that. But I do think that you're right, that the area that really we can get perhaps a larger consensus on than what I think I'd admit is maybe my more out there feelings, is that we shouldn't be forcing these women to play on fucking artificial turf or doing shit like putting them up in Motel Sixes or whatever, like,
or making them fly coach to, you know, coach international to a game. They only got their first chartered flight to a match like last year.
That's crazy.
Where, and I mean, you know, don't believe for a second that the men's team doesn't charter a flight for everywhere that they go.
Yeah, of course they do.
And, you know, that I think that that's the type of thing where, you know, that's just investment in the team by U.S. soccer. And that's the thing where I think the women have the strongest argument of, you know, if you want us to perform the best, you need to treat us the same that you treat the men's team. If you want to, if you want to prove that you actually, you know, because U.S. soccer makes a lot of hay that they're, you know, the leader in investment in the women's team, et cetera, right?
Yeah.
A ton of hay about it. If you actually, you know, want to, if you actually want to show that that's true, you need to give the women's team all the resources that they need in order to compete at the highest level. and not just, like you said, put them up in Motel 6s after a 12-hour coach flight, transatlantic coach flight to the World Cup.
It is just really gross. And I'm glad that the World Cup, I'm glad that the last Women's World Cup brought to the fore the issue of playing on turf, because it is disgusting that we force people to play on turf. Just really bad. Like, these pictures would emerge of these people's legs that would be just covered in turf burn, blood, and bruise. And it's just like,
yeah, it's gross.
It's terrible. This is awful. I mean, we would never.
Zlatan refused to play on like any U.S. stadium that was turf, didn't he?
Yeah, he is right to do that.
Yeah,
this is the appropriate response to being told to do that. And I don't mean to applaud him for doing that and like make it as if that was an option for the women. Like, that was literally not an option. The only way, like, if they had done a strike and forfeited because of the conditions, like, that would have been, that's the catastrophic nightmare scenario, right? But like, it is absolutely unacceptable that we treat the women like that. And, you know, we can maybe disagree on some of the bigger things, but these kind of details, you know, they actually are really important and central to
the feeling of
equality also.
Well, like, it's indignities, right? There are all these little indignities that I think drive the women's players to protest in a way that just the money wouldn't, right? Because it was just the money. I think that more, you know, no one's ever going to be happy that they're paid less money, right? But if it's just the money, you listen to U.S. soccer's arguments and you're like, well, fuck, okay, whatever. I guess they're, you know, yeah, they pay less money for the Women's World Cup. But the other indignities just feel like, you know, they just care about them.
All right, last topic we're going to touch on it briefly because it's been hilarious. And we have to talk about it because it's so on brand. But apparently it's been maybe refuted, not clear. The story is friend of the show, patron of the show, Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, I know you're listening. What's going on, man? As considering buying Manchester United from the...
Hell yeah.
Another friend of the show, the Glazer family. Sell him. Sell him the club, Glazers. I know you're listening. Mohammed King, what's up?
Oh, so good. Our king. He might be crown prince in Saudi Arabia, but he's king in our hearts.
Don't send a hit squad to decapitate us.
I mean, I don't know why you should.
We're doing jokes.
This is loyal subjects.
Yeah, we're subjects.
Loyal subjects of his ephemeral kingdom across the world.
This is what's really cool about this story is that MBS is manifestly not a soccer fan. He like doesn't like this sport. And so it's fascinating to think of him, because this is one of the most obvious examples of people using soft power to try to expand their reach.
Oh yeah.
And all these rumors surfaced like right in the middle of the one of the worst, you know, cycles of news for Saudi Arabia in 10 years. Since 9/11.
Yeah, 9/11, or even since, you know, the OPEC oil crises. But here's why I love so much about this story, right? So there's the aspect you just talked about, right, which is that this is clearly 100% just a response to the fact that Saudi Arabia has been on the verge of war with Qatar for like 2 years, and Qatar obviously has
very invested in soccer.
They've made some investments here and there, you know, little clubs. And so it's clearly this response to that, which is very funny. It's sad, right? It's both sad, but also funny because of how transparent it is.
Yeah,
that these golf countries are just overtly using sports as a political arena.
It is just mask off for these guys. I love it. I mean, Mohammed King, you should absolutely.
It's just it's like trading cards for them. Right, it's like trying to find the best trading card, and they're like, "Oh, well, you got PSG. Well, fuck you. We're gonna get United." Yeah, and really, I hope they do.
I hope they do too, because then we have Manchester City versus Manchester United being a Saudi versus UAE fight, and it's just
makes
it even cooler. Even though those two are allied against Qatar,
dude,
who
imagine
has PSG
imagine
and Barca.
because we, let's be very, very clear about where we live, right? We do not live in the good place.
No, this is actually
the bad place. And in the bad place.
This is the bad place. Yeah.
This is the bad place. And in the bad place, soccer rivalries in a third country where two different countries own the biggest teams will spark a war. And that is what's going to start World War III, right? It's going to be a really nasty Manchester derby after Saudi Arabia has purchased Manchester United. And it's going to spark a global crisis in the Middle East that's going to draw in the United States and Russia. Everyone's going to take sides. It's going to be the great football war. It's what we're going to get.
That's
what we deserve.
I mean, it is what we deserve, is to go down and have this just flaming pile of shit out of our misery. But it's maybe too funny. I think we don't deserve something that funny.
Like,
that's too funny a way to go out.
That was so stupid, too. Yeah, but I agree. We deserve so something dumb. Stupid and sad. It's, I don't know, like, if we deserve something
PSG
dumb and fun.
Poaches Lionel Messi, age 38, from Manchester United, buying out his £2 billion clause. And then Saudi Arabia, like, fucking nukes Qatar.
What I want to see is, I want to see both United and City to be relocated to the Middle East. they'll still remain in the Premier League ostensibly, but they're just going to build a stadium in the Middle East, and they're just going to charter a private flight for each of the players back to England occasionally. But they also won't do that. They'll just pay the FA enough that they don't have to play away games anymore.
Oh, God.
But the war is going to start when our Peaky Blinders guy becomes a United fan because he can't go to Birmingham games anymore, and he's going to jump out of the stands, go, you know, clock Christian Pulisic in the head, and that's that. That's the war.
That's it. That's the war, and it's going to be great. It's going to be great, guys.
I'm excited.
Everything is good.
This is the best case scenario, really.
All right, Evan, it's good talking to you, buddy. We'll catch up more. We're back, obviously, trying to do this as much as possible, but at least once a month. So send us your bad takes, your bad news. It's all good. I mean, this is the bad place.
This is the bad place. It's been fun, man.
Bye. Wait a minute. You know what? Holy smokes. This is the bad place. This is the bad place. This is the bad place. This is the bad place.
The pig's getting angry.
This is the bad place.
Beef, 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 beef.
Oh, this is the bad place.
Who will deny that you and I and
hit me.
When the four corners of this cocoon collide, you'll slip through the cracks, hoping that you'll survive. Gather your weight, take a deep look inside. Are you really who they idolize? To pimp a butterfly.
At first I did love you, but I just wanna fight.
Sign, homie, I'm acting fool. Hit the dance floor, strobe lights in the room. Flash your little secretary, bitch, for the homies. Blue-eyed devil with a fat-ass mouth. I'ma buy a brand new Cuddy on Vos. Truck the hood up, two-time, do flow. Plan them on everything, plan them on wedding ring. Married to the game and a bad bitch shows. When I get signed, homie, I'ma buy a strap. Straight from the CIA, set it on my lap. Take a few M16s to the hood. Pass them all out on a black one's good. I'ma put the cop to swap me by the White House. Republican run up, get signed out. Hit the press with a Cuban link on my neck. Uneducated, but I got $1 million check like that.
We should never cave, we should never cave. Take his money, go back home. Money, go back home. We should never cave, we should never cave.
I did love you.
down to the house. You said you wanted a spot like mine. But remember, anybody can get it. The hard part is keeping it, motherfucker.
What you want? You a house, you a car, 40 acres and a mule, a piano, a guitar, anything. Say my name is Uncle Sam on your dog. Motherfucker, you can live at the mall. I know you're kind, that's why I'm kind. Don't have receipts, oh, that's fine. Pay me later, wear those gaiters. Cliche and say fuck your haters. I can see the bottom in you. I can see the dollar in you. Little white lies, but it's no white collar in you. But it's whatever though, because I'm still following you. Because you make me live forever, baby. Count it all together, baby. Then hit the register and make me feel better, baby. Your horoscope, you're a Gemini, two sides. So you better cop everything two times. Two coupes, two chains, two C-notes. Too much and enough, both we know. Christmas, tell them what's on your wish list. Get it all, you deserve it, Kendrick. And when you hit the White House, do you? But remember, you ain't passed economics in school. And everything you buy, taxes will deny. How Wesley sniped your ass before 35.
Yeah, looking down is quite a drop. Looking good when you're on top.
We on top, you got it.
Metaphors, leaving metaphors metaphysically in a state of euphoria. Look both